At midnight, the three patrols start east. By dawn, Jake has got them within 15 miles of the front, spread out and netted over on a ridge that he describes as a prominent feature, but that Punch calls a knoll the size of a tit. Jake sights our T3 vehicles on the southern shoulder. His design is this. At moonrise, seven of the nine trucks, Jake and Nick's patrols, plus Collie's Jeep and Conningham's guns truck from ours, will continue east until they have set up immediately in the enemy rear. Maine and his SAS teams will have gone ahead. They'll already be there. The remaining two trucks in our T3 patrol, mine and Granger's wireless, will establish a covering position here where we are. Our role will be to serve as a combination rallying point and mobile reserve, to provide cover for all vehicles fleeing towards Sore Thumb, and to pick up any stragglers whose trucks get shot up or disabled in the getaway. Jake's and Nick's patrols and Collie make ready in the moonlight. After a feed and a brew and a final wireless exchange with HQ, they start up and roll out in two columns. We wish them Godspeed. Their dust and the sound of their engines recede into the dark. My truck and Granger's are alone now. I've got Punch and Oliphant. Granger has Marks and Durrance. We dig in on the reverse slope, spading out a shallow gun pit into which both trucks burrow and over which we rig camouflage netting and as much brush as we can gather. The truck's business ends are their rears, over the tailboards, where the guns can fire most effectively. These we position facing east. We clear boulders from the pit rim to protect against ricochets, then bank the parapet with bagged sand, the best shock absorber for bullets or artillery shells. Granger erects the aerial 30 feet downslope. No enemy had better creep up behind us in daylight, because the damn thing will be visible for 5 miles. We must be in wireless contact, though, not only with Jake and Nick, but with HQ and possibly even with the RAF. As the stars come out, I gather the men and go over scenarios. A stew of bully with rice and curry is chased by hot sweet tea and lime cocktail with a double tot of rum. The men are ready. I send Punch and Oliphant down the east face of the ridge to find a way forward and mark it, so we don't nosedive over some unseen drop-off if we have to race to somebody's rescue. Granger and I scout a getaway lane to the west. I order all guns cleaned and oiled one last time, belts and magazines checked, all rounds aligned. We go over jam drills. I stress again that when action starts, firepower is everything. Keep shooting. Maintain controlled, well-aimed bursts. Don't burn up the barrels, but no matter what, keep firing. These are the kinds of orders men like to hear. This is good. I'm happy. A bond is forming between me and Punch and Granger and Oliphant. It's happening in this moment. I can feel it. As the first watch stands to, I sit with two blankets round my shoulders and my back resting against a rear tyre of Tearoa 4, with a mug of hot tea on the sand and my notebook on my lap. Dearest Rose, nestled on a desert knoll, which on a proper evening would make a delightful picnic site, unfortunately, this night, we're freezing our backsides. I assign myself the last watch and bed down under the stars. I wake on my own, 1 minute before Oliphant shakes my shoulder. The moon is down. I'm so cold I can barely move. Time for the wireless. Wake Granger. Tell him to get his ears on. All hands are astir by 04:30 hours. A thick mist muffles sound. The men huddle in their greatcoats with wool caps pulled tight over their ears. I mount to the ridge with Punch and Oliphant. We strain like owls into the fog. The terrain is rolling scrub with numerous low ridges, of which ours is the most prominent, rising about 30 feet from the desert floor. False crests abound, leaving great swathes of dead ground. Tamarisk and creosote bushes grow with some density, broken by stony depressions, stripped by the wind, which stand out almost as if they were paved. You could snug down a regiment among the folds. Oliphant is just asking whether he can risk a smoke under cover when we hear engines.
Quiet.
Granger kills the radio.
Which direction?
We can't tell.
Our blokes?
East, says Oliphant, pointing in the direction our 8th Army will be coming from. The problem is Rommel's panzers will be coming from there too. Engine sound swells and fades. If it's diesel, it's German. We can't tell yet. 1,000 yards and getting louder. I send Oliphant and Durrance to pack up the aerial chop-chop. The other 4 of us hurry to our guns. My heart is hammering. If the approaching force is German, do we shoot it out and get ourselves killed? Or elect the better part of valour and beat it out of here? I order both engines started and all camouflage lines tugged loose, ready to run. We crank all 4 guns round towards the advancing motor sound.
There!
Cries Oliphant. Headlights. Blackouts with cat's eye slits. A motorcycle and sidecar bucks over a crest 150 yards south. Oliphant and Durrance are caught in the open. In the dark, the bike doesn't see them. It roars on, followed by another and another.
BMWs, says Punch. I know the sound.
Are you sure?
I signed to hold fire.
750s, horizontal twins, German as sauerkraut.
Oliphant and Durrance have plunged flat on the sand. The 17-foot aerial masts tower over them. A motorcycle column churns past, each bike following the other's tracks without glancing right or left.
Get that aerial down!
As Oliphant and Durrance scramble, we hear a new rumble from the southern end of the ridge. Before any of us can react, another motorcycle with sidecar heaves into view, sees us and makes straight for us. The bike roars up and breaks in a cyclone of dust. The machine, I note, is not a chain drive, but shaft-driven. Cycle and riders are caked with grit and look done in. The driver tugs his goggles back.
Wohin sind sie gefahren?
He demands. Where have they gone? I cup a hand to my ear.
Was? In welcher Richtung sind sie gerade gefahren?
I point west. Driver and gunner take off. A German scout car bucks past 300 yards south, then another the same distance north. Daimlers, with their bowler hat crowns. Oliphant and Durrance scamper back to the wireless truck, breaking down the aerial masts and stowing them into their carrying cradles. We can see more scout cars to the south, rumbling cautiously across the undulating, still dark ground. Punch and I peer east over the crest. Mist obscures all sight beyond a few 100 yards, but there's no mistaking the growl of diesel engines. Big ones. Mark 3 and 4 Panzers. Not the light Mark 2s that sound like trucks. I order camouflage nets down and stuffed into the truck bed.
Stand by. Ready to move.
There's nowhere to go. Within minutes, the area around our post has become a hive of Africa Corps troops and transport. The build-up happens so suddenly and so matter-of-factly that we almost feel like Germans ourselves. At least a dozen lorries, half of them captured British Bedfords, roll past our sight, following the trail broken by the motorcyclists. Behind them appear more waves of trucks and guns. Oliphant mans his Browning.
What the hell do we do now?
Move with them. To fight is suicide. Sitting still will only get us spotted. Find a cloud of dust and get inside it. We rumble several miles in convoy. Every vehicle but ours is stenciled with the palm tree and swastika insignia of the Africa Corps. Thank God for the dust and the pre-dawn murk. Suddenly the column begins slowing. German military police have laid out a stop line. With hand signals, they are directing units into positions.
They're setting up, calls Punch. Set up with them. Find a spot.
Here come the tanks we heard before. We can see them as the mist disperses, advancing in column on the flat to the south. 30,
40, 50 of them, round us and in front of us. Africa Corps NCOs have dismounted from their vehicles. They're selecting positions, manoeuvring trucks and gun tractors, directing their men to dig in. Signalmen run wire between posts. Anti-tank guns appear enormous, wicked-looking 88s and squat, lethal PAC-38s, towed by half-track lorries and tractors. We're hunting for a spot to blend in.
There? Asks Punch.
A Spandau machine gun crew beat us to it. Go left. More infantry digging in.
There!
We squat down between two hummocks.
Now what?
Calls Oliphant.
Play along.
We dismount. Whatever Rommel's troopers are doing, we do too. A mortar crew begins setting up 100 yards to our rear. A machine gun post appears 50 yards on our flank. In minutes, both have set up and sandbagged. In front, the crew of an 88, joined by mates from a half-track towing vehicle and a 3-ton ammo truck, are digging a gun pit and rigging camouflage nets. We net up too. I smell sausage.
Punch points. Look there, sir. The bastards are cooking breakfast.
We smell porridge and ersatz coffee. The Germans, we note, fry up using the same kind of sand and petrol stoves we do.
Do the same, Punch.
Sir, work up some grub. Act natural.
What preserves us in the midst of the enemy camp is the universal desert garb worn by both sides. Great coats and khaki trousers in the chill, with peat caps, scarves and sand goggles. In addition, both armies have captured and put into service so many enemy vehicles that our Chevrolets look no more out of place than the Africa Corps-ized Fords, Macs and Marmon Harringtons that trundle past us, left, right and centre. Ours look like theirs, and theirs look like ours. Still, we're scared witless. Somehow getting found out seems worse than being killed in action. Simultaneously, the fright is offset by the theatricality, even absurdity, of the situation. We feel like schoolboys pulling a prank. As the minutes pass and we sizzle up our bacon with no enemy catching us out or even taking any notice, an odd sort of exhilaration begins to take hold.
Hell, says Granger.
Do I dare have a crap?
And he does.
Taking a spade for a walk.
Between our post and the 88-gun position 200 yards ahead. At 06:30 hours exactly, the British barrage begins. This clearly is why the Germans are withdrawing. The shells land at first harmlessly in vacant desert, then begin walking westwards, towards us. These are not little 25-pounders, but serious stuff, medium and heavy guns. No one moves. The foe have dug in and snugged down.
Damn, says Punch. How long do you reckon these heroes are going to sit tight?
I've got another concern. Clearly this pullback will alter Rommel's location, and that of Jake and Nick and our SAS teams. My role was to man a position covering our men's withdrawal. All that has changed now. What must we do? How can we help? Plan A is obviously obsolete. I wave Oliphant and Granger over. Get ready to move. Look official as though we've just got orders. We'll go in 3 minutes. Granger stops.
Where are we going?
I haven't a clue.
I'm turning towards Punch to repeat these instructions when an Africa Corps NCO in a Kubelwagen Jeep rolls up to the 88 crew 200 yards to our east and orders them to pack their kit and get ready to move. He reaches us next, shouting the same command. All along the line, gun limbers are being readied and engines are kicking over.
It's about mucking time, says Oliphant.
The whole position is being dismantled and pulled back.
Balls and glory, says Punch. The Huns ain't as dumb as I thought.
20 minutes later, our trucks are grinding north alongside a dust-billowing column of 88s towed by armoured half-tracks. Bucking over a ridge, Punch lifts a buttock and looses a spectacular trumpet.
Damn, he says. I'm even farting like a kraut.